Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Gerardo Ceballos. He is one of the world's leading ecologists and is a professor at the Institute of Ecology at National Autonomous University of Mexico. He's the author of numerous books, including The Skin of the Rainforest, Mammals of Mexico, and The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. He's also known for his fieldwork on prairie dogs, jaguars, and others. He proposed the first Mexican Endangered Species Act that includes roughly 4,000 species of plants and animals. He's seen through to establishment more than 20 protected areas that cover almost 2% of the Mexican land territory to protect thousands of plants and animals, including around 15% of all endangered species. And it's true to say that no other Mexican scientist, perhaps no other individual scientist in the world, has accomplished so much hands-on conservation. So I am deeply honored to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much to have this opportunity to talk to you and your audience.
So today, one of the things I would like to talk about is the prairie dog as a keystone species. You were either one of the people or the person to actually start promoting that idea. So can you tell me, first, can you tell a story of how you were driving across an area and saw a lush field of grass and what that had to do with prairie dogs?
Yes, well, thank you. I am a mammalogist and an ecologist, and I was doing my PhD at the University of Arizona in the late 1980s, and I was one day reading about prairie dogs in Mexico and the southwestern U.S., and the species has basically become extinct on those places. And I was intrigued that there has been no records from Mexico for many years. Nobody has been looking for them. So one day I was going to drive from Arizona to Mexico City, and I decided to take my car. At that time it was a Renault. I mean, a car wasn't obviously not appropriate for doing field work. But anyway, I took the car and I took my wife, and we went and tried to look out for the prairie dogs in Chihuahua, Mexico. Chihuahua is the state that borders New Mexico. So we went there one morning. We set up driving from Tucson. We crossed the border and we keep on going. And we eventually reached a city called Janos, a small city called Janos in Mexico, in northern Chihuahua. And from there, I start to ask people if they will know anything about prairie dogs. And most of them say, well, there are some around and so on. So I was very excited. And eventually, we start to drive into a grassland. It was the most amazing grassland I have ever seen at that time, because it was, you basically will lose your sight in the horizon and there were grasslands. So we start to drive there in a dirt road. And after like 1 hour in the dirt road, suddenly we make a curve and enter what was the most amazing sight I have ever seen in terms of the prairie dogs. It was a colony that at that time extended for 55,000 hectares. It's more 120,000 acres continuously. So it was getting late at that time. It was like a 5-ish in the afternoon. So I drive like for 2 hours, find a place to camp, and we camp in there. And the next morning, we keep on driving around, and it was just an amazing thing because we saw thousands and thousands of prairie dogs. So we have rediscovered what at that time was the largest prairie dog colony left on Earth, and the sight was really, really unbelievable.
And is there a relationship between the grasslands that you were seeing and the prairie dogs?
So when we were there at that time, the idea, there was a very, very widespread idea that prairie dogs were a pest that would compete with cattle, and they destroy the grassland. And then there has been campaigns. I mean, in the USA were campaigns paid by the government to exterminate prairie dogs. And they were very successful campaigns, eradication campaigns. And in the 1990s, prairie dogs have already been disappeared from 98% of the ranges. So the species, although was locally common in a few places, it has basically vanished for most of the North America. Originally, predators were found from Canada, from southern Canada, all through the Great Plains in the U.S. to northern Mexico. So when I saw that incredible sight of the prairie dogs and the grasslands and all this wildlife that I saw in Mexico, it occurred to me that if the prairie dogs were really a pest and were really damaging the grasslands, I wouldn't be able to see the grasslands that I was looking at that time in Mexico. So to make this story short, I decided to, first of all, do some studies with some friends to find out how big was this colony. And at that time is when I realized that prairie dog had been lost in 98% of the range on the one hand, but also that this Mexican colony was the largest left on Earth.
And, wait, can we back up for a second?
Yes.
And you mentioned, can you talk a little bit more about what prairie dogs might have been like prior to the conquest of this continent by Europeans? Because you did say they went all the way to Canada. Like, do we have any idea what may have been the largest individual community of prairie dogs? And can you give some numbers? Like, we know there were 60 million bison. So how many prairie dogs? Do we even know? Or like, I did a talk in San Francisco last fall. And before I went there, I looked up what San Francisco, what the early European explorers described San Francisco. They said that the bay was paved with sea lions. And they said that there were so many whales that sometimes the air stunk, because evidently whales have pretty bad breath.
Yes, yes.
So
that's a good point. I will let you know that. So before I go into Mexico at that time, I have read the earlier accounts of prairie dog, their abundance and so on. And for instance, across the Mexico-U.S. border, when they were putting up the new border between the two countries, there was this scientist, Edward Mernz, who was able to see colonies there that extended more than 20 kilometers long. And let's remind the audience that this part of Mexico and the U.S., southwestern U.S., is the southern limit of the prairie dogs in the continent. But then I also learned that in the early 1800s, there were colonies with 400 million prairie dogs. I mean, just one colony is supposed to have 400 million prairie dogs. Although I don't know how accurate those numbers are, what I can tell you is that when we rediscovered the place in Mexico, this just one single colony has 1.5 million individuals. So it is very likely that the 400 million colony that was described in the late 1800s in Texas, going north to the central U.S., was very feasible that there will be so large number of animals. So prairie dogs, in that sense, were one of the most abundant medium-sized mammals on Earth. And let's remember that prairie dogs are more or less like a little bit more than 1 pound, 1.5 pound animal. And they live in these colonies who are loosely connected, but basically these are squirrels that are related to the squirrel family. And those animals are basically living in these colonies. When you see the grassland, you see the grassland dotted with small holes, and the prairie dogs live on those holes. So, I mean, probably there will be billions of prairie dogs when the first Westerners colonized North America. Unfortunately, those sites are gone. But just to give you an idea, then when I was there in Mexico thinking about how these animals could change the environment and looking at the grassland dotted with prairie dogs, so it didn't make sense to me that these animals were a pest, were causing damage to the environment. So being a scientist, what I decided to do, first of all, is measure and evaluate how many animals there were in Mexico. And at that time, we find out that the colony has, as I said before, 130,000 acres. It was a huge colony. And we estimate the population there. And we came out with a 1.5 million prairie dogs at that time there. So they were very, very abundant, and they were very in a very large colony. Then what we did is set aside a series of experiments to try to find out what was the impact of the prairie dogs. And I will mention a little bit more details in a minute. But what we find out is that prairie dogs were not only a pest for the grassland. These animals were basically the driving force to keep grasslands alive. But what we found is prairie dogs foraging behavior, for instance, they destroy the crops that invade the grasslands and keep the grasslands as an ecosystem, because they need to look out for predators. Let's remember that being so abundant and being relatively big animals, they are prey upon by coyotes, badger, eagles, and a lot of animals. So they have to be all the time looking out, trying to defend themselves and trying to find out the predators. So they don't like, to put it in that way, they don't like to see shrubs that don't allow them to see the horizon, because that's the way they can protect themselves against predators. So what they do is they nibble and they destroy the scrubs. And the scrubs in this particular part of the continent, this is a semi-arid grassland, those scrubs put aside by an animal like prairie dogs eventually invade the grasslands, and those grasslands turn into a more desert-like vegetation, where mosquitoes and other scrubs become the abundant plants and the grasslands are gone. So what we discovered with our studies is that prairie dogs are basically what scientists call a keystone species. And a keystone species is a species who has an impact in its environment much larger than you will expect by its abundance. So we start to do some experiments, and this is incredibly interesting. We published a paper in 1994 in Conservation Biology, the journal Conservation Biology, where we basically says that. We said, based on all the information that we have, we find out that prairie dogs were a keystone species because basically three things. One, if they disappear, there is a lot of biodiversity associated to the colonies, like black-footed ferret and many, many other mammals and birds, reptiles, amphibians disappear. And second, they're incredibly important because their activities, they maintain the grassland as a unit, as an ecosystem, and fending off the grasslands against desert-like plants, like mosquitoes, crops. And third, by doing this, they are incredibly important for humans, because by keeping the grasslands, they keep the capability of those ecosystems to provide environmental services, all those benefits that we humans get for free from the proper working of the environment, like forage, water, and microclimate, and so on. So we put together this idea, and we publish it, and we say the prairie dogs were not a pest, and instead they were a keystone species. And what was very interesting at that time is a lot of people, a lot of other scientists started to come out with more information showing that what we have said was really the case, that there was a lot of information showing that prairie dogs are keystone species. And then what we did is say, well, if there were billions of prairie dogs in the landscape and now they are gone, there must be a lot of impact on that landscape. And then we start to dig out some historic records, for instance, in La Jornada region of southern New Mexico. And it was incredibly to find out that an area now covered by scrubs land, and it's very desert-like place, in the 1800s was covered by prairie dogs, grasslands, and it could maintain up to 20,000 cattle heads in an area that now can support no more than probably 100. All this information keeps us letting us to try to understand more what was the role of prairie dogs on these issues. And in the last 10 years, what we have done is we have done some studies to see the prairie dogs compete with cattle and what is the specific role in the environment. And what we have found is like we have a big enclosure, experimental enclosure in Mexico. It's like 500 hectares. In that area, we put cattle, prey dog, and in areas where there are prey dogs. And in the cattle, we put them a radio collar, so we know every 4 minutes where the cattle is. It is two cattle heads. And what we find out is like 95% of the time, cattle spend the time in the prey dog colonies because they really like some plants that are promoted by prey dog activities and are not eaten by the prairie dogs. In other words, what we found, and this is incredibly important, is that prairie dogs and cattle do not compete for forage if they have if cattle is managed at the proper density. And not only that, cattle grows much better where there are prairie dogs than where there are not prairie dogs.
Well, that would seem to make perfect sense to me, since the prairie dogs co-evolved. I mean, they coexisted with large ruminant, you know, bison.
That's a very good point. I mean, originally there were millions of bison and prairie dogs co-evolving in the same grasslands, and they have this interesting interaction. So basically, when we start to have this logic for doing our experiments, what we thought is like, okay, cattle at the proper densities in a grassland may behave a little bit as a bison. And so if the bison and the prairie dog coexist, why couldn't the prairie dogs and the cattle coexist? And we were very lucky to find out that they indeed can coexist. They indeed can bison in many of these habitats where cattle in many of these habitats where bison has been lost can be used to recreate, in some sense, the role of bison. And this is what we have been doing in some of the experiments there in Mexico. And I'm very, very happy to tell you that using cattle at the proper densities with prairie dogs, we have been able to keep on the grassland going, even now there has been a tremendously drought in that part of the continent for several years. And what is also very interesting, by keeping the cattle, you keep the livelihood of the people, obviously, but also cattle has some important effects on the habitat because they droppings or their urine also fertilize the grassland. So, having prairie dogs and cattle together and being able to manage them for nature, we have been able to keep a lot of other animals going in the same places, peccaries, deer, pronghorn antelope, and black-footed ferrets, and many other mammals and vertebrates.
So you mentioned the thing about how the plants in parts of New Mexico and other places have been affected by the eradication of prairie dogs. And that reminds me of a line by Simon Ortiz wrote about how when the Europeans first arrived in New Mexico, they were met with grasses that came up to their knees when they were riding on horses. And my sister lived in New Mexico, so I've spent some time in New Mexico, and frankly, it didn't seem like tall grass prairie anymore. It's obviously been changed pretty severely.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly right. So if you when I was in Mexico, the grassland that I saw there in northern Mexico in the late 1980s, it was like a landscape of the past, because most of this kind of habitat has been lost in the U.S. and in Mexico. And basically, those areas where we are working to save the prairie dogs in Mexico are really, really a habitat of the past, an ecosystem of the past, in the sense that most of it has been destroyed by human activities, either cattle grazing or agriculture and all the changes that are associated to these large-scale human activities. What is important about it is like having been in such a difficult times of change with humans. We are too many people on Earth. We are 7.3 billion, and we are growing by 250,000 people a day. And these people has a huge impact. All of us have a huge impact on the environment. So it is important to find examples like prairie dogs and cattle where we can manage cattle for providing benefits to humans and to us. But also we can do good management, proper management, and we can keep ongoing the productive activities while preserving nature. And I think this example of the prairie dogs and the cattle and the grasslands and the wildlife in Mexico, it can give us some ideas that it can be done in many places on Earth if we will put enough research and ecological research, we can end up having good recipes of how to manage the habitat to couple development with conservation. And I think this is one very important lesson from the Janos area in Mexico, is it can be done. If it can be done in that particular area that is very water stressed and it is in the borderline between the grasslands and the arid regions and so on, in many other areas who are less stressed climate in terms of the climate, it can be done. The second part is like the second lesson for me is like we have to do an effort to really try to understand how to do this coupling. Because we're really now, because of the population growth on the one hand, the inequities on the distribution of wealth. I mean, very rich countries and very poor countries, or very rich individuals in a country and very poor individuals in another in the same country. The consumption or with consumption patterns and the energy we use, basically fossil fuels, we're putting too much stress on our planet. And having find out things like what we found with the prairie dogs and the grasslands, it gives me hope that if we put our best bright minds on solving the question of how we humans can coexist with nature without destroying everything, I think this is one of the most important challenges in the next 3 or 4 decades. Let me tell you that I'm kind of concerned that the rate of change for natural ecosystems and the number of extinct and endangered species on the one hand, and the way we're losing those environments and those species, and we're losing also the ecosystem services that nature provides for humans, I think we're putting too much stress on the environment on the one hand, but that stress and that particular impact is causing tremendous constraints on the way society is our society is sustained, and basically all these problems, environmental problems, can be easily become economic, social, and political problems.
Well, and of course they can, because without a natural world, there is no society whatsoever. I mean, it always strikes me as completely insane about this culture that it promotes the economic system over the natural world. Clearly not. I mean, that's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, since without a natural world, you have no life whatsoever.
Well, that's a very good point, because exactly, I mean, we can, and humanity has gone through a really big, huge economic crisis and has been able to come out, and political crisis and has been able to come out properly, and social problems the same. But let's remember, as you say, that if we continue eroding the environmental elements and functions that provide the conditions that make Earth suitable for life, we're really eroding, at the end, what we're eroding is the capabilities of Earth to maintain human civilization as we know it. And that's my main concern. I mean, one of my major concerns is, as you said, I mean, it is very, very hard for me to understand why economists still don't get the sense that resources are limited, I mean, are finite, and we still do our developing main developing ideas and trends, as if the nature and in particular and natural resources in general were limitless. So basically, I think that going back to the prairie dogs, this model ecosystem now, this model study that we have been doing in Mexico and now with other people in the U.S. is telling us that there are big problems that are destroying our ecosystems and species. Also, that this can be solved with science and technology and a sensible way to try to couple development and conservation. But also, this is telling us that the window of opportunity, the window of time is really small and is closing. Unless, and this is a firm belief, and I will be very responsible to say something like this, if I didn't have enough scientific evidence that this is occurring, I really think that we don't have more than three, four decades to really do a major change on the way we do things if we want to avoid, as I think your President Obama said recently, to live in a nightmare. Right now, we have been living in a nice dream, and I think I wish we can put our act together. We can work for to save nature, to save prairie dogs, to save grasslands, to save all these incredibly ecosystems where these species are, and in order to maintain biodiversity on Earth. But if we are incredibly selfish to maintain just human civilization the way we know it now on Earth, and it is very important. It's very important that we understand the urgency of the problem, that we understand that there is not much time left. And I will be incredibly happy if I'm proven wrong and somebody came out and showed with data that what we're saying that we are what we're saying that we are understanding based on our data, scientific data, is wrong.
I don't see even a prayer of all of that being wrong. I mean, wildlife in general has decreased by 50% over the last 40 years. I mean, the world is collapsing. I don't know. I mean, even every year I see fewer migratory songbirds than the year before. It doesn't matter where you are. The world is really collapsing.
It really doesn't matter, as you say it. And let me tell you something. We just published recently a paper in the journal Science Advances. And basically, we did an analysis, a very, very conservative analysis of how many species have become extinct on Earth, vertebrate species, meaning mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fishes, in the last 500 and the last 100 years. And what we found is like the species that were lost in the last 100 years, they would have been lost in 10,000 years on their normal extinction rates. Meaning, if we were not being part of the problem and having such a big impact on Earth, the species that become extinct in 100 years will probably have become extinct in 10,000 years. So we lost in 100 years a species that under normal times would have been lost in 10,000 years. That's the a huge impact on biodiversity. And as you say, we see every unfortunately, every 2-3 weeks, there is a more bad news. The elephants collapsing because of the illegal trade of ivory and bones to China, and tigers and lions and jaguars and I mean, the list of species is becoming endless. So, but what I would like to say here is like this is can be very overwhelming. But what is still good news, and I don't know if this will be good news for a long term, is that we can still do something. And what I will urge you, our audience, is that we all can contribute to try to make this planet safer for wildlife and plants, and by doing that, by saving as much as we can of plants and animals, wild plants and animals, we are doing a great favor to ourselves. Because every time we say prairie dogs, or we set aside a new protected area in Mexico, or we manage to maintain and recover a species of endangered fish in the southwestern United States, or the tigers in India, or the elephants in Africa. The bottom line is that we really are doing a great favor to nature, but it's also we're doing a great favor to us, because this is the only way that we will be able to maintain the well-being of humans, is maintaining nature that gives us so much for free.
So I want to go back to – thank you for that. And I want to go back to prairie dogs and a few things. I wrote a few notes as you were talking. One of them is that there are you said that they like to be able to see the horizon. And I was born in Nebraska, and there are tall grass prairies in Nebraska too. And I'm just curious, do prairie dogs like tall grass prairies too, or only short grass prairies?
Well, there are different species of prairie dogs, and usually they like both. But when they are in good densities in tall grass, what they do is also they nibble the grasses and keep them at a certain height where they can see properly in the distance. And it's incredibly nice, because if you will see some of the experiments that we did, there were areas where there were these mosquito crops coming up, really invading the grassland. And we will reintroduce prairie dogs on those areas. Within 1 year, the area was free of mosquitoes, and then the grasslands has been colonized. The grasses have already colonized that area. So just imagine that you are a prairie dog. You have many, many things that want to eat you, like eagles, coyotes, and so on. And you cannot see where they are coming from. And then you do something on your surroundings, and you see the enemies properly, the predators properly coming. So they have really, really developed this behavior to clear up the vegetation around their habitat, so they can see properly.
So the next thing I wrote down, thank you for that. And the next thing I wrote down is that, I mean, it's pretty obvious why prairie dogs re-inhabiting a place would help coyotes, foxes, badgers, eagles, those who eat the prairie dogs. But you also mentioned amphibians, and how would prairie dogs, how do they help amphibians, and how do they help some species that aren't quite so obvious as they just eat the prairie dogs?
That's a very, very good question and very good observation. Well, let's remember that in places, in the grasslands, basically there are few places to get refuge, I mean, to get cover, and because there are few rocks and few logs and few holes. What prairie dogs do is they create for the refuge. I mean, they live in burrows, and those burrows can be incredibly abundant in a prairie dog colony. And those burrows provide a refuge to many species like frogs, salamanders, rattlesnakes, and many species of invertebrates, lizards, scorpions, spiders, and so on, for two reasons. First of all, they provide them refuge. And second, the prairie dog holes usually has a much pleasant temperature and humidity than the place outside. In other words, because they're on the ground and they're deep, they have they are much less affected by the changes in temperature during the day or during the year. And let's remember that prairie dogs live in places where it can become really, really cold. So by being inside, the temperature is much less cold or less hot in the summer than. And also then by being the refuge for many, many invertebrates and vertebrates, it also attracts I mean, those animals also are preyed upon by other species. For instance, horned lizards, they live inside the burrows, and they eat a lot of the crickets or spiders or ants who live there. And rattlesnake, they find out also refuge there, and they can eat some of the baby prairie dogs, or they can eat kangaroo rats or other animals living in the burrows.
So who would be one of the most surprising plants or animals who is either dependent upon or helped by prairie dogs? So salamanders I found pretty surprising. Are there any plants or animals who are even more surprising?
Let me tell you. Sorry, let me tell you that one of the most endangered mammals on Earth is the black-footed ferret. And the black-footed ferret, this is a weasel. that it has evolved to feed almost exclusively on prairie dogs and to live exclusively in prairie dogs colonies. So this animal is very long. It is the size of a small cat. And basically, it lives in the burrows of prairie dogs. It feeds on the prairie dogs. And all his life cycle depends on prairie dog colonies. So when the big collapse of the prairie dog colonies across the continent causes that this species was declared extinct in the 1980s, fortunately, a colony was found in the U.S., and the U.S. government started a captive breeding program that has been incredibly important to save the species from extinction. And let me tell you something else. Prairie dogs, well, we have been working really hard to save them, prairie dogs, and all the species associated to them, like the black-footed ferret. And we were doing really well until recently. We were doing really well because there were big colonies in Mexico and then in the U.S. and so on, and black-footed ferret in the wild were bouncing back from extinction and so on. But unfortunately, there is a disease. The pest is a disease that was introduced from Europe in the 1800s to the U.S., and it has been spreading from the east, New York and those regions, to the west. And many of the colonies that we were able to recover and were doing really great has been, prairie dog colonies, has been susceptible to pest. And some of the most important one has collapsed recently. We, even in Mexico, we find out that the one that we have been working lost more than half of the of their size because of what we believe is that disease.
So is that disease continuing to expand? It's expanding in territory, but are there prairie dogs who are developing immunity to it, and the towns are recovering, or is this perhaps fatal?
No, it is. That's also a very good question. I mean, the disease is spreading towards the west in the United States and towards Mexico. But scientists have been working in the last few years on developing a vaccine that can be provided in the food in pellets to the prairie dogs, and it's been proven very successful in two ways. On the one hand, to prevent the plague will destroy the colonies massively, but also by providing some safe havens to some of the colonies and some of the animals who are developing some resistance to the disease. What I want to say, pest is a plague. Also, they call them plague.
And so you said early on that when you first saw that that prairie dog community, it was the largest. I believe you said it was the largest in the world. But you used the word past tense. So is that no longer the largest because of that plague?
It used to be the largest when we discovered it. Then there was some colonies in the U.S. here that recovered and were more or less a similar size. Then we have a big collapse in Mexico that we don't know. We still don't know if it was plague or not. It just simply, from one year to the other, the lots of our colonies were lost. But now, our colony in Mexico, I think, is again the largest one because we have been doing big efforts to promote it and enhance it and save it from the disease. And so for a while was the largest one, and then it was the third or the fourth largest because some of the colonies in the U.S. have grown larger. But now, again, maybe with one in the U.S. is, again, the largest one left on Earth.
You know, prairie dogs, the collapse of prairie dog populations by 98% is, for me, one of the signs of how terrible the dominant culture is, because prairie dogs are so forgiving. I was born in Nebraska and grew up in Colorado, and so I saw prairie dogs all the time, and you will see prairie dogs on the median strip of interstates. They are not one of those species who has really, really specific habitat requirements. And if anything changes, they're not fragile, is what I'm trying to say. And that both makes me really sad, because if they can be reduced by 98%, that's a very bad sign. And on the other hand, their resilience gives me some what tiny bit of optimism I have for the future comes from creatures like prairie dogs and salmon, who are so incredibly resilient. And if they're left alone, they can improve the grasslands, or in the case of salmon, the forests, very, very quickly, and they can re-inhabit very quickly.
Well, that's a very good observation, because exactly, I mean, prairie dogs probably will never become extinct as a species, because they can survive in the smallest strips of land, even parking lots or in the middle of the highway and so on. But what we find out there is that by losing the population, what we call the population extinction, is that basically we're losing the ecosystem services that they provide when they have large colonies and large numbers. So in that sense, I think that is incredibly important to understand that although they may not disappear, because as you say, they are incredibly noble creatures and they can adapt to survive in tiny places, by losing the big colonies, we're losing the real role of a keystone species. On the other hand, because they are rodents and they're adaptable and they are resilient, they can be brought back to the habitat, and with some management, we can have hope that we can get back colonies that could be really, really large. And that's our goal. Our goal is that in the future, in the near future, we will be able to work between Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. and have a few hundred thousand acres covered by prairie dog colonies stretching again from Canada to Mexico.
So I have three or four quick questions. We've got like 3 or 4 minutes left. One of them is, you also mentioned microclimate. And when you said microclimate, how prairie dogs affect microclimate, did you mean microclimate within the burrow, or do they actually affect the climate, the microclimate directly surrounding and above their burrows?
So it's both. They have a big impact on the microclimate of the burrows, as we mentioned it. But also, what we have found is that the water infiltration, the humidity, and other environmental factors associated to climate in the places where you have the prairie dog grasslands are much more better than in the scrubland associated to the scrubland that you got when you lost the prairie dogs. And for instance, the microclimate, when you get the prairie dogs, the infiltration, to give you an idea, the infiltration, water infiltration of rainfall, it is much, much higher there than in the scrubland.
You know, I'm really smiling when you say that, because there's I don't remember which indigenous nation it is, but there was a group of American Indians who say that when the prairie dogs are eradicated, then they say, who's going to bring the rain?
That's exactly right. I mean, there is more rain in places where there are prairie dogs and there are more infiltration and the soils are more fertile. I mean, it's a lot of interesting things going on there. I have a student who finished a master's degree recently, and what she did is compare the ecosystem services provided by a prairie dog grassland and a mesquite scrubland next to that. And what we find out is, like, it's incredibly important. Soil fertility, soil oxygenation, infiltration, soil depth, and humidity, relative humidity, and so on. So many things are much, much better in the prairie dog towns and colonies than in the grassland, in the mesquite scrubland that invade the grassland when the prairie dogs are lost.
Okay, that's great. And two more questions. One of them is, so if you could have the listeners to this interview take away one thing about prairie dogs that they know in their heart and it changes them. And that so later in the evening or the next month, they're saying, wow, I heard this great interview. And they say, what was it about? And they give, like, what's the one or two sentences that you would like to encapsulate that they understand about prairie dogs?
What I would say is that prairie dogs are incredibly nice and interesting animals that are endangered with extinction because of our activities and that are critical to maintain the grasslands in southwest of the United States and Mexico.
And then the last question, that's great. This is great. This whole interview is great. And the last question is, so if somehow you are made the king of all things prairie dog and you can basically set whatever policies you want, specifically about prairie dogs, the rules are you can't reduce human population and you can't get rid of capitalism. So you can't make those larger structural changes, but specifically having to do with prairie dogs, what would you want to put in place?
Well, what I would put in place is to escalate what we have found out in our experiments in Mexico, that we can couple development, cattle ranching, and so on in this prairie dog ecosystem, that we can couple them with development. What I will really say, to do that, you don't have to change the social or the economic model. What you have to do is to implement on the ground what we have found, and it works. I mean, this is also very helpful. We don't have to change and to do many of the things that we have to do to save prairie dogs on the one hand or biodiversity on the other hand. You don't have to change the whole social, political, or economic system. You have to make changes and adapt it to what we're learning from science.
Well, thank you so much for everything you've said, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Gerardo Ceballos. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.